See, last season doesn't matter anymore. Come April, what matters is this team, this group of players, this group of fans, and the name across our chests. This season is about making sure history remembers us as we wish to be remembered. This season is about adding to our legacy.
And I can't wait, Dodger fans.
Spring is here. Or at least spring training is, along with all the ritualistic warmth and hope that brings. The hope that a polarizing pitcher like Trevor Bauer, who you just heard, was a wise acquisition. And the hope that someone, anyone really, can compete with those defending champion Dodgers. Today, Jeff Passan joins us en route to the Cactus League to distinguish delusion from reality and to welcome you back to the game. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Monday, February 22nd. This is ESPN Daily. Jeff Passan, we're talking to you before you get on a plane somewhere. Where are you headed?
I'm going to Phoenix, aka Fernando Tatis Land.
Jeff Passan is an MLB insider and also the Weird Al of ESPN.
You know, it's officially going to feel like spring training. I know pitchers and catchers have reported we're going to have full squad action this week for the first time. And a week from today, I believe, actual baseball games begin.
We will get to Tatis and I presume the billboard that has been constructed in his honor in Phoenix in a little bit. But you said it. Spring is here. Pitchers and catchers have reported to camps. You're headed there today. What are you most excited to see?
I'm most excited to hear, actually. Baseball is a sport that so many of the senses get tickled, whether it's the smell of the grass and,
yes,
the sound of a bat crack and of mitts popping, or what you're able to see, these incredible athletes taking a little 5-ounce orb and doing unbelievable things with it. And the sights, the sounds, the smells, I am excited for it all, because I would like to believe that baseball represents our first sporting foray back into relative normalcy.
Mm.
There are going to be fans in stands almost everywhere you go. They are going to be playing, presumably, a full season. And I think by the time the year is done, hopefully, after the World Series, we will have seen full stadiums that are full because the country and the world are healthy enough to support that.
So you described a sensory overload beyond what the normal baseball experience is like because of COVID, because of the pandemic, because we're at this point where maybe there can be some normalcy. So, Jeff, what's the plan around health and safety to get to something resembling normal in spring training?
I mean, there's a 100-page document that lays out in extremely granular fashion what baseball is trying to do to prevent outbreaks. And you remember, Pablo, we talked about it last year. We saw it with the Miami Marlins, with the St. Louis Cardinals. Teams are susceptible to that. I will say a very positive thing that happened already is Major League Baseball's first round of intake testing, where they had 4,336 tests. They didn't give the number of test subjects, but among those tests, only 13 came back positive. It's a very, very small number. If there is an outbreak, Pablo, it would not surprise me at all, considering the way that people at spring training are around one another so much, but they are abiding by distancing protocols. They're limiting the number of players. Nobody's allowed to go out. And the hope is that over time, as players get vaccinated, that will change. But for the time being, it's very similar to the way that they operated toward the end of last season.
And if you were to rewind, Jeff, for a second here and just think back to what spring training was like last year, how would you summarize what that was?
I don't even remember anything other than March 12th. I had a sense that day that it wasn't just baseball that was changing. It was life that was changing. And there are a lot of things in life that I can sort of just, like, brush off my shoulders. But the fact that we were going to be entering this new world, you have no idea what that looks like. And so spring training 2020 for me is a giant blank space, and then March 12th with 10 exclamation points.
So let's get to the present tense here, because as you alluded to, you're going to see the Padres and Fernando Tatis Jr. And I mentioned that there probably would be a billboard, but now I'm doing the math in my head. And when you get a 14-year, $340 million contract extension, Jeff Passan, you probably get more than just one billboard. So what
I was going to say, is he going to be the first guy to get a statue while he's still playing?
Yeah, Jeff, he's going to get like one of those Pacific Rim Jaeger fighting robots, I think, like a Gundam style thing, more than just a statue. But tell me about that deal and your reaction to it when you saw that it happened. What does it say about what the Padres are seeing in this young kid that you profiled for us on this podcast?
When an organization puts $340 million in front of you, it's very difficult to say no. And Fernando Tatis Jr. loves San Diego. He loves the Padres organization. He loves where he is right now. And when they put that figure in front of him, he didn't say no. He said, I do. And that's what this is. This is a marriage between a generationally good player and an organization that has had only one of those throughout its history in Tony Gwynn. I live in Kansas City, Pablo, and my 13-year-old is a Royals fan, and he has worn his Fernando Tatis Jr. t-shirt so much that it's got a hole in it. And it's not one of those holes that you can patch easily. So it's honestly like I worry when he walks outside with it that people look at him and say, "What's wrong with you, child with hole in clothes?"
Your dad is walking you wearing a full suit and you have holes all over your clothes.
And perhaps my trip out to the Phoenix area will include the purchase of a new Fernando Tatis Jr. t-shirt for him. Mm. Baseball has not had a player like Tatis since Ken Griffey Jr. That's the last time somebody has had the swag and the marketability and the extremely wide grouping of people who are attracted to what he is and what he does. And what a gift that is for not just the sport, but for the San Diego Padres.
Well, let's get to the team that the Padres are chasing, the most talented team in baseball. And it's just funny, Jeff, to think about this, actually. Like, back in my day, when I was going to spring training and seeing you there, and we were getting weird dinners with Wright Thompson, the Padres weren't spending like this, but the Los Angeles Dodgers, I mean, they're spending now more than anyone ever has, it feels like. When you look at the Dodgers and their defense of their World Series championship this season, what comes to your mind?
I'm not a gambler because at times in the past, I haven't been very good at it. But I ask myself, would I take the Dodgers or the field to win the World Series this year? And I know mathematically the right answer is you take the field. You take the field because in a division series, yes, with five games, maybe the Dodgers run into some unbelievable pitching. You take the field because in a seven-game series, whether it's the NLCS or the World Series, maybe the Dodgers' bats just don't show up. Small sample sizes being bad are a very real thing in baseball. But when I look at this roster top to bottom, from its rotation to its bullpen to its everyday lineup to its bench, there is no weakness on the Dodgers. They are a juggernaut. And the question for the Dodgers is, do they have the chance to become a dynasty now?
You know, Jeff, Trevor Bauer, I think as well as a journalist as anybody working in our business, what does he do? What does his acquisition do for the prospect of the dynasty you just referenced?
I mean, the guy who was the best pitcher in the National League last year now joins a rotation that already has Walker Buehler, Clayton Kershaw, Dustin May, David Price, Julio Urias, Tony Gonsolin. to me, it's not even as much that top-end talent that he brings. It's the depth. And in a 162-game season, Pablo, after a 60-game season, that's going to be a big question for teams. How do we get guys innings without pushing them so much that they're going to get hurt and leave us bare?
Jeff, how the Dodgers got Bauer is also fascinating to me. And look, Bauer as this character, sometimes he strikes me as a guy who is brilliant and very rational. Other times he strikes me as extremely problematic and someone whose brain has occasionally been consumed and eaten by the internet itself. When you were watching his courtship process, his decision to go to LA, why did the Dodgers make the most sense for him personally as this character?
Because so many of the principles baseball-wise that he adheres to and really has grown to embody are things the organization itself stands for. You know, the Dodgers were very early on not just the sabermetric train, but on the idea that pitchers can turn themselves into something even more than what their physical ability gifts them. The idea that the Dodgers have embraced different training methods and looked at pitchers as much more valuable than other organizations have, or really the sport of baseball has in the past, I think really appeals to him as an intellectual exercise and challenge. But the point that you made there about foibles, whether it's on social media or otherwise, it's a very real thing. I think they believe he is worth it for the money. I think they hope that he's worth it for what he provides when he's not pitching.
The team that I want to ask you about that is certainly not the caliber of the Dodgers is the New York Mets, but they do have an ownership group and a financial backing and Francisco Lindor now, who seems to be one of a couple of building blocks that they feel really good about to get fans excited about what they have coming up this season. What do you see happening with the Mets in New York?
As excited as I am for the Dodgers and Padres playing 19 games this year, it's pretty close with the Mets and the Braves. The New York Mets are a very good baseball team right now. And it's interesting because I think if you were to ask Mets fans, they would be a little angry with this offseason because they didn't get George Springer and because they didn't get Trevor Bauer and they didn't get JT Realmuto and they didn't get DJ LeMahieu. It's almost as much about who they didn't spend money on as who they did. But the big transaction of the offseason for them clearly was trading for Francisco Lindor, and the hopes of Mets fans, jaded Mets fans, angry Mets fans everywhere, is that by the time the season begins, he will have a Fernando Tatis-like deal.
Jeff, coming up, I want to talk to you more about this upcoming season, who you really like, who's under the radar that I could steal to make myself look smarter, and what exactly is happening at the very top of the sport.
Delicious meat, nutritious. In the snack that packs a real protein punch, Wonderful Pistachios, one of the highest protein nuts out there. Each 1 ounce serving has 6 grams of protein, giving you over 10% of your daily value. Trust me, I've been eating them like there's no tomorrow all week. Wonderful Pistachios also come in a variety of flavors and sizes, perfect for enjoying with your family and friends or taking them with you on the go. And you, like me, are on the go a lot. Taking the kids to school, hopping from meeting to meeting, shopping for groceries, whatever it may be. Well, the good news is, not only are Wonderful Pistachios a complete protein providing all 9 essential amino acids, they're also great for all your adventures. So whether you're a pistachio purist who loves cracking open every nut or you prefer the convenience of no-shells pistachios, Wonderful Pistachios has got you covered. Grab Wonderful Pistachios and elevate your snack game today. Visit WonderfulPistachios.com to learn more.
So, Jeff, before we get into the actual baseball talk here, I do want to ask you about one of your areas of expertise, which is MLB collective bargaining agreement disagreements. So, in your latest piece, you note that we're about 9.5 months away from this CBA expiring. What implications does that have on this season for the owners and the players?
it's a black cloud, right? I mean, I have a piece up today on Fernando Tatis Jr. and how this is the year of Tatis. And that should be really exciting. And it is. But the idea that 9 months down the road, we're looking at December 1st, this collective bargaining agreement expiring, and the possibility that it's going to not just expire, but there will be a lockout, and that this lockout could last in 2022, and that it potentially could lose games. I'm not there yet, but even the possibility of it puts a damper on my excitement for 2021. And there is so much to lose in this sport that I hope they can see the forest for the trees, both on the league side and the union side, and figure out how to keep a B-plus of labor piece going.
But the warning signs, Jeff, how many are there? Like, when you come to this from that Debbie Downer, sad trombone perspective, that's not just because you're a natural pessimist, although you may well be.
I'm not.
It's because you're seeing stuff. What are you seeing?
It's not because I'm seeing stuff. It's because I hear stuff. And when I'm talking with prominent people on both sides and asking them, should I be worried? And the answer is yes. Well, that tells me what I need to know. I think there is a understandable fear here that this thing can go sideways very quickly. And the reason is because the foundation right now on which collective bargaining is built is typically mutual respect and mutual goals. The goals for both are there, but they don't quite align. I'm hoping that the goals overwhelm the lack of respect. And I was talking with someone last week, and he said, you know, this whole idea that we don't like each other and that it's going to get in the way is overblown. And I was happy to hear that. Let's just use this possibility that I want to get a new car, and I go into a dealership, and the person who's trying to sell me the car I don't trust. Am I going to want to buy the car? Am I going to want to do business with this person? Of course not. When there are feelings there where you don't trust the other side, it has to color the negotiations. And that coloring is what I'm afraid of. I'm afraid of, instead of a rainbow, it's just going to be black.
My favorite part about your analogy there, which makes total sense to me, is that the commissioner before this commissioner, Bud Selig before Rob Manfred, people made fun of Bud Selig for being a guy who looks like a used car salesman. And you're telling me that...
Well, he was.
Was Bud Selig literally a used car salesman?
Bud Selig sold cars. Yes, that's accurate.
That's amazing.
Here's the thing about that. He was a deal maker. And Rob Manfred, as commissioner, has made deals. But this is going to be the hardest one, probably, of his career.
So that is the backdrop against which a sport you're very excited about is nevertheless taking place. So, Jeff, let's get back to the optimism for a second. Let's cut the trombones. Let's cut the sadness. Let's cut the pessimism. You're an optimist now. If you're an optimist in the National League and you're not the Dodgers, who are you?
I mean, I'm the Padres. I love the Braves. Like, I really do love the Braves. Bringing back Marcelo Zuna, going out and getting Charlie Morton, getting Drew Smyly. They get Mike Soroka back from his Achilles injury. They're young. They've got Ronald Acuna, Ozzie Albies, Dansby Swanson. Oh, by the way, Freddie Freeman. I mean, it is a stacked and loaded team. And the only thing, at least until October, that can get in the way of the Atlanta Braves to me is the National League East. It's a grinder of a division. The Mets, we talked about already. They're really good. The Washington Nationals still have Max Scherzer, Steven Strasburg, and Patrick Corbin at the top of their rotation, and Juan Soto, who is the best hitter in baseball. The Philadelphia Phillies have talent. I don't know if they're going to win. And look, I know a lot of people are sleeping on the Marlins and saying, you know, how are they going to compete there? They made the playoffs last year, and they have a very good young rotation and some dynamic offensive players who are going to be coming into that lineup. And so I think top to bottom, the National League East is the best division in baseball.
So let's pivot here to the dudes in the American League East. Who are you hearing looks the best heading into spring training?
If they stay healthy, the Yankees are the best team in the American League. I look at the American League West. It's just not an impressive division. The Astros aren't what they were. The A's aren't what they were last year. The Central, to me, is as much as the East has a Rays team that, despite losing Snell, still, I think, can be ascendant, and a Blue Jays team that went and added George Springer a year after adding Hyunjin Ryu, and a Red Sox team that I think is probably going to be better than expected, even though they've just made incremental moves this offseason. God, I love the American League Central. The battle between the White Sox and the Minnesota Twins is going to be fantastic. Cleveland is going to be a sneaky team, not just because it added Eddie Rosario, but that rotation completely overhauled from the Kluber, Bauer, Carrasco, Clevenger. They've lost those four guys over the last couple of years, and they still have Shane Bieber and Aaron Civale and Zach Plesac and Tristan McKenzie. Even teams like the Kansas City Royals that went out and traded for Andrew Benintendi and signed Carlos Santana and Mike Minor, and the Detroit Tigers with AJ Hinch now in his manager, a really good young rotation, and they've got Spencer Torkelson and Riley Green, who are probably going to arrive within the next year or two. The AL Central is be a meat grinder in 2022 and beyond, but even 2021, it's a really interesting division.
So I need a team, Jeff, an under-the-radar, dark horse kind of candidate that, as I said, I can steal, pass off as my own, look very smart as a result, never crediting you specifically. And I can't say the Yankees. That seems too obvious at this point. So of those teams you named, who would you advise me to bandwagon in an attempt to look like I'm ahead of the curve?
Maybe this is just a function of my unfettered man crush on Juan Soto as a baseball player. I love watching Juan Soto hit Pablo. It is a religious experience. Juan Soto, and I don't say this lightly, might be Ted Williams. Now, Ted Williams was the last 400 hitter in baseball. Ted Williams.
I mean, Jeff, Ted Williams. I mean, I think Bob Ryan is currently dialing my phone. The universe has alerted him to yell at me for even having you on to say that Juan Soto is Ted Williams.
Let's put it this way. Juan Soto got to the big leagues when he was 19 years old and spent that full season at 19 and got on base 40% of the time and slugged 520. Last year, Juan Soto hit 351 with a 490 on base and a 695 slug. In this era where everybody, Pablo, strikes out all the time, Juan Soto walked 41 times and struck out 28. That's 28 strikeouts in 196 plate appearances. It's right up there in the top 10 in all of baseball. And oh, by the way, he happens to hit the ball harder than just about anyone as well. You don't find this combination of skills. And this is said with all apologies to Mike Trout and to other players of that ilk, but I think Juan Soto is in a class of his own.
Jeff, I hesitate to say this as we wrap up our podcast, but I can hear you. I'm using my most acute sense here to hear you begin to craft a parody song in honor of Juan Soto at some point this season.
If Juan Soto is hitting 400 in June, Pablo, we will be back June 1st on this podcast. I will not only have four bars for you like I did with the Rosarena. There will be a full song. And if he's, let's put it this way, if he's hitting 400 or is at 400 at any point in May, you get to pick out the song and tell me, and I will get to work.
Jeff Passan, I cannot tell whether I want that to happen or if I want Juan Soto to tap out at 399.
Thanks, Pablo.
Okay, up next. Why all of us should be listening very closely to Naomi Osaka.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home some huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Here's another story I want you to know. You can't see Naomi Osaka win the Australian Open and not think of Serena Williams. Serena is one of Osaka's heroes. Serena is who Osaka crushed in last week's semifinal. Serena, in short, is the human being Osaka will be most connected to for all time. And not least because they are two black women in America who are both outspoken about exactly what that means. But after winning her fourth Grand Slam Saturday, Osaka spoke about her all-time ambitions. And the best women's tennis player in the world name-checked someone else.
Hopefully I play long enough to play a girl that said that I was once her favorite player or something. For me, I think that's the coolest thing that could ever happen to me. I think I have those feelings of, you know, watching my favorite players. Unfortunately, I didn't get to play Li Na, but I just think that that's how the sport moves forward.
Naomi Osaka was 13 years old when Li Na became the first Asian-born man or woman to ever win a Grand Slam, winning the French Open in 2011. Just 2 years ago, Li Na became the first Asian-born player to be inducted into the International Tennis Hall of Fame. "Whenever I talk to her," Osaka said of Li Na in 2019, "I feel very nervous and I start sweating and I rub my palms." Now, to be clear, these two women grew up in very different places. Osaka was born in Japan to a Haitian dad and a Japanese mom, and they immigrated to America when she was three. Li Na grew up in Wuhan, China, the future epicenter of the pandemic, and she chafed against the oppression of a state-run sports machine that she fled in 2008. Japan is definitively not China, and the Philippines, for that matter, where my family's from, is not Korea, and Vietnam is not Thailand, and so on and so forth. But so many of us find inspiration across this insanely vast continent, because one defining thing about the Asian experience in sports and pop culture generally is that we only have so many people who kind of look like us, let alone people who speak up on our behalf. So when Osaka credits Li Na, whose individualism and skill and humor inspired her as an Asian athlete, that feels familiar. And when Osaka speaks out against this wave of anti-Asian violence, especially against the elderly, that swept across America in the past year, that means something even more. The amount of hate, racism, and blame for COVID towards the Asian community is disgusting, Osaka tweeted before the Australian Open. The fact that this topic is not very widely covered makes me concerned. And while I'm here, Osaka added, saying ching chong and shrimp fried rice when talking about slash to an Asian person isn't cool. You aren't funny, it's not a joke, and you're beyond pathetic. End quote. So yes, when you see Naomi Osaka, see Serena Williams, absolutely. But just know that so many of us recognize ourselves in Naomi Osaka, too. I'm Pablo Torre. This has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.